You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to tonight's program. I can barely see all of you, but thank you so much for being here. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs, the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation, in partnership with the Los Angeles Public Library, is helping to define the library of the 21st century, a place that is bigger than any single building and more than the books within it. It is a place that facilitates equal access to information and ideas and helps to nurture literacy, creativity, and curiosity in all. It reaches out to form community, and in doing so becomes inclusive of the larger world in which it stands. If you are interested in supporting the vital work of the Los Angeles Public Library and in attending more programs, you can become a member, right, of the Library Foundation tonight just outside in the reception area after the program. As we look at the 21st century, tonight's guest, Anand Giridharadas, and Sarah Jones are both speaking out for change. I've been a fan of both of them for years, and so to have them here on one stage is remarkable. Each in their own voice is an activist challenging the status quo, helping to make a difference and to change our world. They both confront sensitive topics head on without fear. Their different approaches are a stimulus for thought in all of us. Also, to be at Barnsdale for this event is oddly fitting. Elaine Barnsdale was an heiress to an enormous oil fortune. She came west in 1915. I've got to find my next note here. To build an innovative theater company with the help of the rebel architect Frank Lloyd Wright. She wasn't looking to change society, but was interested in creating a cultural eccentric haven in the Wild West. Anand Giridharadas's book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, is a call to restore democracy to our country. He takes a close look at the immoral system in which we've lost ourselves. Our public policy and our leaders are no longer reflective of the hopes and dreams of regular people in our society. Where did we lose our way? We'll learn more tonight. Anand Giridharadas's other books include The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas, and India Calling. He is an editor at large. You know, sometimes you read these people's, it just makes me want to get under the sofa. He is an editor at large for Time, an on-air political analyst from SMBC, as well as a former columnist and correspondent for the New York Times. He has been the recipient of numerous honors and awards, including an outstanding Lifetime Achievement Award for Humanism and Culture from Harvard University. He's only like 36, so a lifetime achievement. Sarah Jones is a Tony and Obie award-winning performer and writer. She's best known for multi-character, one-person Broadway hit, Bridge and Tunnel, originally produced by Meryl Streep. And most recently for her show, Sell by Date. Jones has given multiple main stage TED Talks, performed at the White House and the United States of the Women's Summit for President and First Lady Obama, and at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. She is a vocal advocate for the empowerment of women and girls globally. In her role as the UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, she has performed for audiences around the world and raised awareness on issues including ethnic, racial, and economic disparities in the U.S. Most recently, Jones launched Foment Productions, an entertainment company focused on social change. This is not out and in the press yet, she just told me tonight, but look, keep your eyes peeled for her new show on CNN this fall. Please welcome these two remarkable people, Anand Giridharadas and Sarah Jones. Thank you very, very much.
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. We're here.
What a nice group of people.
Already, it's begun quite well. Anand, I couldn't be more excited to, first of all, I brought my book because I'm a really, I mean, if you, how many, does everybody, I hope you've all got it. And I hope that more than having gotten it, that you've got it, Do you know what I mean?
Well, I see what you did there.
You see what I did there? It was nothing as deft as what you manage in these pages, which is to get people to question pretty much the entirety of what we think doing good looks like in our culture. One question I have, because I know you personally, is has there been fallout on a personal level for you? You're talking to friends about, you're kind of, you know, really calling people to account for their behavior, and some of these people are very close to you. Has there been any kind of fallout from that?
Yeah. It was a tricky book to write, in part because of anticipating that, and not quite knowing how much of that there was going to be, and also sort of not caring as a matter of my personality, but also caring because I'm human. And as I was writing it, you know, the book, for those of you who don't know anything about it and just got it and don't even really want it, it is a book about how the richest and most powerful people in our time have grabbed more and more wealth and power in our time, have used that wealth and power to buy political influence, which helps them capture even more wealth and power. And then, before people could get angry enough to do something about it, have conquered the space of social change itself, have co-opted the idea of revolution, and turned themselves, in many of our latent imaginations, into the saviors from the very problems they're still working to cause. And
yeah, that's.
I say that just because you got to understand why it may have been possible to lose some friends. And you know, I am—I'm not coming at this as someone unfamiliar with the world. I am a writer. I'm not a business person, but I also, like many writers and artists, I'm sure it's the same with you. You can kind of become an adjacent figure in this world, right? They like having people like us around because they are often quite boring themselves. and so there's a jester quality. They need entertainment. And sometimes we risk becoming the entertainment. And, you know, those people are smart often. They like ideas. They read books. They read sometimes your book. And I was afraid of that, but I was also determined that that's my job. The whole job is to say the things people are not supposed to say. That's why we keep writers around. And when it did come out, to finally answer your question, I was surprised that many, many people, people often I didn't know, who are in this group of people that I indict, didn't reject it outright. In fact, more people than I expected, and also institutions that I wouldn't have expected. There was a foundation 2 days before the book came out representing some of the worst money in America. I was told by someone at that foundation that an email went out from the head of that foundation to the staff saying, "This author is saying that what we do is quote-unquote fake change. Come in Monday prepared to discuss whether in fact we are fake change and what to do about it." I didn't expect that. Yeah. I have billionaires reaching out to me saying, "I don't agree with 80% of what you say, but I agree with enough to be concerned that I'm on the wrong side of history. Yeah. What do I do?" So that was good. The fallout that was not as good is there are a lot of people, and it's often not those billionaires themselves. It's the staffers of the billionaires. It's the people who run conferences for them. It's the people who raise money from them. It's their philanthropic advisors and consultants who are barnacles on their wealth. Who, many of whom, I think secretly in a deep way, this is my suspicion, agree with parts of what I'm saying, but are kind of like bodyguards of the plutocracy and are not open to this in a way that the plutocrats themselves can sometimes be. And some of those people have either dropped off, kind of not been in touch, and in some cases been pretty explicit about, "Hey, you're a nice guy, but your tweets are pretty hostile to plutocrats. So we don't feel comfortable having you around in spaces where they're gonna be." And that's been explicit. I've been disinvited from things. I've been not allowed to go to things where my wife, just to support my wife.
Your partner, Priya Parker, who is a writer, a brilliant writer in her own right. Yeah, that's, so you've now kind of, as a family, she's kind of got, you know, she's still welcome, but how long before The Art of Gathering.
She wrote a book called The Art of Gathering, right. So she's about bringing people together, and I'm about driving them apart.
No.
And it's a, you know.
I think you're about bringing them together in a way that's aligned with some integrity and some honesty about hierarchy and privilege. And right. Well, I want to say, so you and I met in part because you were talking about kind of the bodyguards and the, you know, I feel like we met behind the velvet rope of the, you know, the jester conversation. I do grapple with that, right? Sometimes I worry that there are bells on my little pointy hat, that I'm invited to these things to entertain and to assuage guilt, to be the brown. You know, we get to be the brown. I joke about our aerodynamics, the two of us. And we met at TED first. And
the conference, not the guy.
Not the guy. Is there a guy? But, you know, the idea that for both of us, there are truths that are unpalatable for this entire, you know, where does my privilege, you know, I love you're so candid and so transparent about your own relationship to this, right? You weren't kind of born clear on these ideas. You were at McKinsey at one point yourself. You know, kind of came to understand all of this. I guess what I want to ask, and I've brought along a few friends who are fans of yours, fans of the book. There may be one or two barnacles who want to defend the plutocracy, but I'll bring somebody along. So when I first got to TED, I portray people of lots of different ethnicities. That's what I do. I know it's weird. It's okay. Anand can take
this
it.
This is not cultural appropriation.
This
it's
is
art.
Not cultural. No. It's in the reverse. When you're brown, you just sort of get to, right. You know, you just get to sort of say, all right, we've had to listen to you for a good long while.
It's called recompense.
It's called recompense. It's called, you know, sort of vocal reparation. I don't know. But I want to ask Anand, because you know this, when we are there and when, you know, you kind of move people and are part of this, I know that for me, part of my entree into that world included being a bridge. I get to sound like this and sort of bring this idea of privilege and look like this, and everybody feels just a little bit better. Everybody goes, oh. And do you feel that you sort of represent that bridging of, you know, sort of giving people a sense of, no, no, we're all right, Anand's here. You know, we can't be that bad, he's here. And do you feel like this book has sort of, you know, forced people to open their eyes to the fact that actually there's still, you know, when I drop that and I sound like this, am I as welcome at the party when I'm nasal and flat again? Yeah.
I think there was certainly a moment, and I'll tell you about it, when I did feel I was playing that role of, we must be okay, we must be legitimate if Anand is here. And now I think people feel like we should probably leave if Anand is here. So I'll tell you the story of how we went from A to B. I was a writer doing writing. And in 2011, around my 30th birthday, I got a phone call inviting me to join this benevolent open secret society called the Aspen Institute. And you know, the Aspen Institute has a bunch of different, it does a bunch of different things, national security, stuff around central banking, you know, stuff around local community economics in America. But this program is called the Henry Crown Fellowship, and it was kind of a young leaders program. And everybody's got a young leader. Obama's got a young leaders program now. The Clintons had a young leaders program. The World Economic Forum has a young leaders program. I'm sure the Saudis have a young leaders program.
Young male
I think
leaders.
It's at the Ritz.
I think it's the young male leaders program.
And so I was invited in this program. And the program is basically to try to take mostly business people, actually, and have them read and go on a journey of deepening and actually think about how to make the world a better place and solve these social, the world's biggest, most intractable problems is the idea. And again, to go back to the earlier theme, because a room full of 20 business people is like free Ambien, they would invite one or two non-business people into each class. An artist, a writer, a television person. I'm not sure they still do this, by the way. But they did it, and I was the Indian spice.
The cardamom of
yeah,
the...
Yeah, exactly. they thought I was cardamom. I became paprika. So I'm in this thing, and the experience of the 20 was lovely. Mm-hmm. It's like when you know, any kind of small bonding experience, you go deep, you share things. It was beautiful. But it was the larger, it was the entree into that larger Aspen world and network, going to Aspen several times. You know, I started to have friends on with private jets, and you think, okay, yeah, sure, I'll take a ride.
It's a fine way to travel.
Yeah, it is. It actually is one of those things that it is better. you know? It's not like that Warhol line about a Coke is just a Coke. Like, no, private jets are genuinely better. And spent a lot of time with people who were coming to Aspen, unironically, to talk about making the world more equal and just and a better place.
While their private plane is being fueled.
Correct. And so, like, the climate change irony was sort of an obvious one. But as my time in that world went on, and yeah, I was going to those parties where, yes, the parties were absolutely legitimated by my presence, because there was not a lot of other presences of, you know, people kind of darker than tan. And so I started to realize, and it fills me with shame that I didn't realize it on day one, second one, but over time I started to realize that it was very weird that a lot of the people in this network and world in Aspen, gathering in Aspen to talk about making the world better, were in their day jobs the people making it worse. Right? They were fighting on both sides of the war. They were working at the hedge funds that were pushing for unequal taxation and various things, and then coming to Aspen and talk about how do you fight poverty. They were working for the big tech companies that were abusing our privacy, compromising our democracy, and then they were coming to Aspen to talk about, to sit in the Coke seminar building, named after the brothers, not the beverage, and talking about how to make the world a better place. You had the Aspen Ideas Festival sponsored by Pepsi and Monsanto.
I was there, guilty.
Yeah. Right? Yes. Which is a nice, you know, combination. Pairing, as they say.
Pairing,
a fine
yes.
pairing. Always have your Monsanto with a Pepsi. Enjoy your Monsanto with a Pepsi. And it just started to dawn on me that not only was it hypocritical, but that it was actually a genius racket. Because when you cause social problems through your lobbying, through your not paying taxes, through selling products that, you know, shorten kids' lives, if you just do that and then hide in your house in Connecticut, people are going to find you.
Right.
It's actually better and smarter to get out in front of it and claim to be changing the world, making a difference, giving back, donating here, donating there. And I'll just add this one thing that happened today or yesterday that I think is so significant that really reveals what I learned in the Aspen world. Which Warren Buffett was giving this statement, I don't know how many of you saw it today. CNN asks him about his healthcare initiative. It's like the three bros you don't want fixing the safety net in America, fixing the safety net in America. So it's him, Jamie Dimon, and Jeff Bezos. Have created a company called Haven, as in heaven, Haven.
Or taxes.
Right, exactly. Taxes the same number of letters, but better. And they're gonna fix healthcare, the healthcare system, $3.3 trillion industry. And today he gave an interview for which I am so grateful, because he was actually honest. Mm. And he says at the end of this interview, he says first, we are the three people best qualified to fix this. And then at the end, he reveals what is always fundamentally the motivation behind rich people taking over, Columbusing social change. He says, the private sector doesn't make improvements to our healthcare system, there's gonna be a public fix.
God forbid.
That's what I want. If you take away one thing from today, that's what I want you to understand.
Yeah.
So much, and Warren Buffett is as nice a person in the plutocracy as you will find, as genuine. I don't think he's actually particularly interested in spending money. This is someone who is as good as it gets in that world, and yet the motivation is so often to change the world, to make a difference. Fundamentally, it's about staving off other ways of actually making the world a better place. Real ways of making the world a better place.
Democratic ways.
Democratic ways, whose only shortcoming is that they would cost the plutocrats wealth and power.
Right. Yes, please.
Uh-oh.
I brought a friend. She misses you. So this is someone who agrees with everything you've just said. And, okay. All right, good evening, everybody.
My name is Lorraine Levine. I'm here because the girl Sarah Jones, who you just met, she's a very nice young black performer. And, yeah, well, you know, she calls herself black. Yeah. Anyway, she puts me in her shows, what she calls her one-woman shows. You know what that means. I mean, she takes the credit, makes me come out here and do all the work. But I love Anand. This book, I'll tell you, at my age, I won't tell you how old I am. Guess for yourselves if you want to. But I'm old enough to remember my parents talking about robber barons, this term. And you were one of the first people who's making the case that in order to reach that kind of wealth, you have to be robbing it from the workers. You have to be robbing it from the society at large. And that we are supposed to have a government by the people for the people, and instead we have a government by corporations and by their philanthropic arm, and we don't even get to vote for them. What do we do to stop this, Anand? And I don't have a lot of time left.
Lorraine Levine. It goes without saying that I've never been in an interview like this before.
I love you so much.
And I will never actually be able to enjoy another interview again. You know, Lorraine's parents were of the age where that term robber barons was not a strange term.
Right.
And, you know, 100 years ago in this country, we were in a moment quite similar to this one, except our kind of common culture and norms and assumptions around great fortunes were very different than they are today, right? You may not know that when you had the first kind of what we would now call billionaires trying to set up foundations and do philanthropy, Rockefeller, Carnegie, the general reaction in America was hostile, simply to the act of them giving money away. Like, that sounds crazy to us, because who, even, I don't think Bernie Sanders would be against wanting to start a foundation today, right? And Theodore Roosevelt said, no. No amount of generosity after the fact can make up for how you made the money, right? No thank you, right? You had writers, journalists, mainstream newspapers, people of all kinds, and they had a couple objections. One, you're laundering your reputation, you're covering up for sin. Number two, even if you're not, it's too much power for a person to have over public life, public questions. When people are tinkering with the healthcare system, that's public, right? Whether the solution is public or private, that's a shared thing. Who allows you to have a say about that? That's more than you get through the vote thing that we do.
That old thing.
And then what happened was those philanthropists reacted, softened their pitches, but they ended up prevailing, creating foundations, giving money away. They now give away $400 billion a year, all philanthropy in America. It's rising in such a way, as federal discretionary spending has fallen, that there may be a time where philanthropic giving in the United States exceeds federal discretionary spending, which should tell you something. So it's essentially private government. And what happened as they started sprinkling all that coin was attitudes started to change, because a lot of attitudes started to be on the payroll of those people.
Yes.
They're sponsoring newspapers, they're buying magazines, they're donating to foundations, they're donating to nonprofits through their foundations, and lo and behold, you start to have this culture where, you know, Rob Reich, a great theorist at Stanford, talks about this as kind of reflexive gratitude, right? The default attitude in America to rich people making a bunch of money in whatever ways they did and then giving it away has gone from reflexive skepticism to reflexive gratitude. And the reflexive gratitude has now, I think, in the last year or two, finally started to crack. If you look at when Bill Gates made his announcement about giving back, it was pretty uncritical adulation. If you look at Zuckerberg, still pretty uncritical adulation several years ago when he made the initial announcement. When Bezos made his announcement last fall, the day one story was, Yeah, but you don't pay your workers a lot. Yeah, but what about the tax issue? Yeah, but you're a monopoly. Yeah. And that is not bad. That is not mean-spirited. That is healthy. Yeah. That is healthy. Because no one is saying that these people are all bad any more than it was true that they're all good. What we are saying is, in a democracy, we are skeptical of any exertion of power over public life. We never trust that our politicians could possibly have a good motive. Even though many of them actually live lives that are pretty hard and make much less money than they could. We hold all as we should. Just because soldiers are motivated to serve by a noble impulse of sacrifice, we don't not have people investigating war crimes. We don't have, you know, we don't tell congressional committees to just let whatever the Pentagon does go, right? Noble motives are not an immunity from scrutiny in a democracy. But there's this one area with $400 billion of money a year where we just treat good intentions as a license to do whatever, so that people like Mark Zuckerberg, having made a ton of money with what started as maybe like an attempt to get dates at Harvard and then has become something that may have compromised our last presidential election and is meanwhile abusing all of your privacy, taking the money he made doing that and giving it to causes like reforming public education, which he knows nothing about, and overruling people who do and who are elected by the people, and his initiative to get rid of all the diseases, which is so remarkable when your own company is a plague. Yeah. It is, and all I want is for the Zuckerbergs of the world. Don't worry, we got the disease thing. We actually have a pretty vast infrastructure for trying to fight diseases.
It needs to be funded.
We just need you to not be a plague,
right,
and to pay your taxes so we can actually do what
exactly.
We do.
Right.
Here.
So another friend wants to play devil's advocate, but she wants to tell you she loves you first. So she's going to do
it. It's not going to be the worst that I've ever gotten.
It is not going to be the worst that you've ever gotten, because hopefully she's principled about it. Okay, so first of all, hi, my name is Nereida. I'm very excited to be here. As a Latinx, I just want to say you pretty much look like half my cousins. I'm half Dominican, half Puerto Rican, all proud. But I feel very comfortable sitting here with you right now. The hair is a little bit less curly, but other than that, basically, primos. You know what I'm saying? You and me. What I want to tell you is that I hear you, everything that you're saying. I want to be very practical and pragmatic about, like, especially for me. So coming from a Latinx background, looking around at, like, what's happening at the border. I mean, tomorrow is going to be the one-year anniversary of, like, the separation of families. So I totally agree with you. Is there a world in which we take their money while they're giving it for these emergency life and death situations right now, while we also gradually, I don't know, is there such a thing as like a philanthropic truth and reconciliation? I don't know. You got to like come forward and admit, I got this money from Rockefeller. I got this money from, you know, Henry Ford, whatever, Nazis, all the horrible things that I mean, when I did my research, I was like, oh my God, I'm taking these grants from these people. And then I was like, yeah, but I'm taking these grants from these people. You know what I mean? Because for right now, people are dying. People need to eat. People need to, you know what I mean? So how do we do that? It's not really devil's advocate, but I guess what I'm saying is, I'm sorry, I'm getting nervous because I'm so excited to have met you. But, you know, like while I was reading it, I was like, easy for him to say because he already went to the Aspen thing and he already knows all the people and blah, 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 blah. And I have a Metro card. You know what I mean? I'm from New York. You know what it means. Anyway, that's what I'm saying.
They have no idea what a Metro card is. That is a great question. I'm going to answer it two ways. I think there's something really true about it, and there's also something problematic about it. Here's the problematic part, and let's stick with Zuckerberg and the border and immigration, because it's a perfect example. Mark Zuckerberg is a hero on the issue of immigration. He has an organization, that forward.us, some letters missing, that works on those issues. I think in Mark Zuckerberg's heart, he would do anything for undocumented people. I'm sure his heart bleeds for that. I have no issue with his work and I have no issue with his feelings on that issue. And I know he works hard on it. The issue is, in Mark Zuckerberg's attempt to make money and grow his business, which is where the money to do the immigration work comes from, he may have helped tip the government of the United States.
Oh my God, I know he did. I
mean, from Hillary Clinton to
totally.
Donald Trump. Or certainly played a role in allowing a massive disinformation campaign. Right? Where 70,000 votes with a margin and tens of millions of tweets and Facebook posts, it's plausible to think it's within the realm of that. And so then you say, if the guy is by day pushing this country in a direction where public policy for the entire United States is so hostile to immigrants, and then taking a little bit of that and supporting immigrants, A, that's toxic. But for your point of view as the person has to either take the money or not, in a certain small way, in the moment you take the money, you are legitimating the loop. Right? That's the difficulty. That's the difficulty. And there's no question, I believe, that if Mark Zuckerberg had had zero philanthropic glow over the last 10 years, imagine all the stories that are about him changing the world, just that entire lens with which we have seen him.
I mean, he married a person of color. That was all we were like, oh, it's a little bit, you know what I mean.
Very woke. Very, very woke.
A little bit. Un poquitito, but still, you know.
And if you take that away from the last 10 years, I think regulators and journalists would have come for that guy so much faster and harder than they did.
I hear you.
And I think America would be way better for immigrants than it is right now. So that's the first thing. I think, by the way, the Sackler family, you know, which, you know, if you enjoy the opioid crisis, be sure to thank them, the Sackler family. I think it's also inarguable, and New York State now has said as much in its civil complaint against members of the family, that if they had not given to nice causes like this, you know, they wouldn't have had immunity from prosecution, and you may have had 100,000 fewer people die because that New York City case, New York State case, may have come 10 years ago instead of now. So, I want to address the thing you are suggesting, because I do think it is possible to give, whether it's the giving or to receive that kind of money, in ways that deal with the bleeding and attend to the disease. And I'm going to give you the example of a conversation I had at LeBron's school.
I mean, come on, he was at LeBron's school. So I'm just saying, I'm not giving my check back, but go ahead.
So I go to do some reporting on LeBron's school in Akron, which is this remarkable effort and philanthropic effort. But what's really amazing about it is he chose to work through the public system, which is sort of one of the things I advocate for, that he gave, he's built a new public school.
Yes.
And it actually is, it's not cherry picking, it's cherry picking the worst, most hard-pressed students in that district. It's saying, like, give us the tired, huddled students, we'll take the hardest cases, and, you know.
We like to call them underserved, but I know what you're saying.
Right. I was quoting the Statue of Liberty, but thanks.
Exactly.
For,
no. Emma Goldman, no. Okay, keep going.
So you walk in, and there's a wall of shoes, his shoes. But there's only one of each shoe. And you're like, where's the other shoe?
Waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right? And they're like, well, we auction away the other shoe. And that's one of the ways he raises money. He's put his own money. He's now raising other people's money. And this school is amazing. Mm. And this school is what you're talking about. This school is stopping the bleeding, right? It is not dealing with the injustices of the world. But this room has a pantry where any parent or kid can go in and get like Costco tubs of peanut butter and cans of tomatoes, and there's another room where there's blankets and other supplies. So and there's another room, this is amazing, where there's a city bureaucrat who is assigned to the school with a computer. So any problem you have, like your pension didn't come, or you have some issue with your insurance, any like the kinds of things that take parents 5 days waiting in line to solve, you go to your kid's school, and that city bureaucrat will just fix it for you, so you can actually like go to work,
amazing,
take care of your kid. Brilliant. It's called wraparound services. Many amazing of you probably know that word. Brilliant. The issue I had with it is it was not going to touch any other school in that city.
Right.
And that's sad, right? Because this is so amazing. And it's not going to touch any other school because it's dependent on so much damn money being thrown at a few hundred kids. Mm-hmm. And so I had this fascinating conversation with the principal, in which I basically asked what you asked me, which is, you're stopping a lot of bleeding here that is immediate bleeding, and that is great. I don't think anybody would begrudge you that. Are there ways to do this that would tend towards
scalable,
dealing with why this is happening in the first place and scaling it up? Yeah. So one of the reasons it's happening in the first place is Ohio has relentlessly, under John Kasich, cut taxes, business taxes, other things. There's also inequitable funding. So there's districts in Ohio that get $30,000 per student, and there's that district, I think, gets $5,000 or something like that per student,
wow,
right? Is there a way to be present on that larger conversation while stopping the bleeding?
Right.
And she was struggling with it because, frankly, her job is hard enough. She didn't need me coming in there giving her more homework. But we started to kind of talk together about, okay, what if you run this school and you're stopping the bleeding? But then, while you're doing it, you bring in one of the best documentary filmmakers in the world to show and make a video about LeBron shouldn't have to do this, right? What if LeBron starts a super PAC? I'm not a big fan of super PACs, but I might get on board with this one. He starts a super PAC so that he uses and name it after the school and then fund candidates who commit to solve the same problem systemically instead of through a philanthropic patch.
Yes.
There are ways to take the school and attach things to it so that the immediate fix connects to broader fixes. And I think more people who are trying to do that giving or more people in nonprofit will need to think about how do you cure the bleeding and heal the cancer at the same time.
Yes. Beautiful. Yes. Oh. So as I'm lamenting the fact that I'm going to walk back out there into a world where this is not yet happening, I do want to think about the practical, actionable, right? We have elections coming up. Like, how can we actually put into practice some of the brilliant ideas that you're sharing that are in the book and that you and Robert Reich and others are talking about? And I'm thinking about one person who's concerned about the bleeding and the cancer. I met this woman. All of my characters are loosely based on real people. Anna knows this, but I changed the names to protect the innocent and especially the guilty. But I come from a multicultural family, and I've seen what our government is unable to do in part because of, right, jobs being moved overseas, right? We know why our tax base has shrunk. We know about the deindustrialization of our cities. We know that there are all of these kind of multi-layered underlying problems, kind of like what you illustrated in the LeBron in that instance. I have some relatives who have benefited over time from philanthropic efforts like Head Start. You know, it's really fascinating when you look at what philanthropy has, you know, kind of brought to people. And then I look at, for example, the fact that the GI Bill, I didn't know this, but there was a de facto Southern senators, you know, kind of carving out black folks so that they couldn't access those benefits. And so the middle class kind of rose without black folks. I don't know if people are aware of this, but these are the kinds of things that when I look at what some philanthropy, you know, the redress that can be there, I wonder, for a person like this person who's going to ask you a question, is there a way in which the reparative, like what you're talking about with LeBron and scaling it up, and that we also address Native Americans whose land we stand on, who, you know, we kind of, I mean, it almost feels like there needs to be an amends making along with stopping the bleeding and curing the cancer. Is there kind of a, I don't know, an overall transfusion that we need to engage with? And so I just want this woman to ask you.
My name is Miss Lady. That's not my government name. My government name, I'll share it with you because I believe in you. All the rest of y'all, close your ears because I don't know you like that. Don't call me my real name, Dolores. But I say my name, Miss Lady, so people have to respect me at least one time when they see me. And I live on the street. When Sarah Jones met me, she said I'm homeless. I tell her I'm not homeless. I may don't have me a house. That just make me houseless, you know. But philanthropy, sometimes the only access seem like some people have to people, like you say, civil rights, they done took it away or whatever. Where the money gonna come from? Who gonna fund the Black Lives Matter? I tell you who funding it right now. It's philanthropy. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect, but I am worried that this country, what if they don't never admit why we got so much inequality. People say, oh, I wasn't there when there was slavery. It don't matter. You could look back in your family history and see where you got handed the house, and this one got a house, and this one got an inheritance. So I wonder, maybe we don't call philanthropy, but it is a way that folks could vote and be in the democracy, but still give people back what they owe. My people worked hard and didn't get nothing. I want to know, can philanthropy change in a way that you, Anna, point out? People deserve to get what they're worth. And I think we might still need a little philanthropy for that, but change the name, change what it is. You agree with me?
I do. And one of the... That's such a good point. And I want to be clear, I am not on record anywhere as saying we got to shut down all philanthropy. I think in a more just world, the kind of world you're talking about, there would be fewer billionaires, if any, and there would be fewer billions to give away. But we're not in that world right now, and I get that. I'm an idealist and a realist, and I understand that we may never get to that world, and if we do, it'll be a long time. So right now, there is this money, and you can either buy yachts with it, or you can try to do something. And I believe that with some of these bad actors, like Zuckerberg and the Sacklers, we would actually be better off if they just bought yachts, because then they wouldn't buy this moral glow that prevents us from dealing with them. Mm. And they may be living in public housing known as prison. But for a lot of other folks who have that money, whether it's $10 million lying around or $50 billion, I think there are better and worse ways to give. And there are ways to give fundamentally that prop up a bad system, that legitimate a bad system, and there are other ways to give that break down the very bad system atop which you stand, right? And so the advice that I give philanthropists when they, for whatever weird reason, would want my advice, would be to think about what is traitor to your class giving look like? FDR, one of the great institution builders of this country's history, was a traitor to his class. Lincoln was a traitor to his race, by the understandings of many people at that time. And it's much easier to not be. And those people were so significant because they served a higher cause than just repping their tribe. And so I think a lot of the things you're talking about, when you have philanthropists supporting Black Lives Matter, when you have philanthropists, they are pushing for the kind of change that is not going to aggrandize plutocrats. If Black Lives Matter gets the world they want to live in, it may be slightly less good to be a white person in Greenwich keeping all your money, right? If you have more of those Black Lives Matter generation of activists running for office, my guess is they're going to vote for higher taxes over time, right, among many other policies. So that's the kind of giving that I deeply respect. The kind of giving where you are not trying to have three white guys in their middle or late stage of life trying to reimagine healthcare, but instead, if they had taken that same money and were training activists and organizers and people running for office in communities, so that we have a majority able to address healthcare systemically 20 years from now, I would support that more. People who donate money to a charter school so they can put their name on it, and as one of my characters says in the book, tell all their friends they got three black boys into Yale, I don't like that. But if they were to support those scraggly lawyers who are right now fighting to win a Brown v. Board of Education style case for class in this country, so you can't fund public education by local property taxes, so one school gets this and another school gets that, that would be a very good use of philanthropy. And by the way, it seldom happens. You know how much money's been spent on charter schools? You know how little money those scraggly lawyers get? So there are ways to give that put your own privilege at risk. Yes. And those are the ways you described. And I want to say on the specific issue of reparations, truth and reconciliation, I think this is a very live, exciting place for philanthropic work for the following reason. In a way, the best place for philanthropic work is stuff that has two qualities. One, like Head Start, it will eventually be a government program, but it can't be one right now, because not only is it not at 51% support, it doesn't have like 4% support, right? But you know that it could. And so what you do, what they did with Head Start, which I think could be a template for reparations or other things, they, at the University of Iowa Child Welfare Station, they, funded by the Rockefellers and others, they tested a theory about kids that was controversial at the time, which is that environment can overwhelm the effect of birth, heredity, right? They thought if you came from bad stock, nothing you can do for those kids. And so they took kids from bad stock and good stock, or however they define that, and they gave them like nice toys and good teachers and a safe environment, and lo and behold,
they turned out great.
There's no such thing as bad stock.
Right.
And except vegetable stock. And so that didn't stay in some little research project or become some private for-profit social enterprise. That became Head Start, which had 500,000 kids in it in the first year. So all of these business people love to say, you know, we gotta scale, scale. The business people love scale. You know what has a lot of scale? The fucking government.
Yes.
And so.
Can you make a t-shirt, please?
Reparations is a perfect case for this kind of experimental work where you could imagine for the next 10 years, you have people funding, how would it look? Right. Doing polling on it. Doing workshops, doing trials, doing tests, picking one city, doing it there, picking an island and running massive things where no one can see them. You know, whatever. Make funding documentaries.
We call it in the theater.
Laying the groundwork. But then, at some point, when we're ready, bringing it home, bringing it into the public. That is one of the highest and best uses of philanthropy. But it is seldom what happens now. When you have all these people who are entrepreneurs, that's how they made their money, and all they want to do is run their own show.
The moral glow, I love that you, I mean, it's so, and I want to say that I think we've arrived at the time when these lucky folks get to do what I've been doing, which is get...
Asking questions in voices?
Asking questions in voices. They better be good. Don't embarrass me.
This could go really wrong.
This could go terribly wrong. Yes, we'll think about cultural appropriation later, but I think we have mic runners, and I'm positive that we have eager question askers here among us, so...
Can we have a little house light? So we can
yes, because we can't see you. We know we can feel you're delightful and divine, but there you are. Yay.
While there isn't any ethical capitalism, there is harm reduction. So, and you brought up reparations really recently. What is your version of harm reduction right now? For, let's say, you wanted this, the whole idea about scaling up. What can people here in this audience do?
That's a great question. You know, there's a lot of different things you can do. I mean, I would say I'll give you a high level answer, then a more specific answer. I think one is to just join. One of the things that has allowed the plutocrats are very organized because they're not that many of them, so it's pretty easy to get organized. They just have these like WhatsApp plute chats, probably. it's probably actually like a better app that doesn't even violate their privacy or something. And so you got to think about how well organized they are, and they have all these conferences. They go to Davos, and we are all like tweeting, thinking we are part of something, thinking we're organizing, thinking because we're on Instagram and liking something we're part of a community, and we're not. They have created tools that allow us to feel like we're part of something, but we're not. You know, the people in the civil rights movement knew each other, like they were actually friends. That's how they went and got each other out of jail. Like they were friends. Right, Malcolm Gladwell has a great piece about this, the difference between weak ties and strong ties, and how online ties, even the Arab Spring, it was like people organizing, they didn't know each other. 2 years later, no Arab Spring, right? If you haven't barbecued with someone, you're not in a movement with them. If you don't know about their leg ailment, you're not in a movement with them. And so I think one thing is to actually join things, be part of things. Like, I ask so many people, when's the last time you attended a global conference versus when's the last time you attended a community meeting? And that answer is embarrassing for a lot of people in worlds like this. And so join, be part of things.
What do you recommend we join? I mean, like, because a town hall, right? Something about your local...
I mean, I think it's a mix of just things that are not political and local, which is important because that's actually often where cross purposes... You know, so I have a friend who lives on a lake, and she's on, like, the algae committee. And she's a pretty reliable liberal from Brooklyn, but when she goes to this lake and she's on the algae committee, that is her only space in life to meet Trump people.
Right.
And it's really good. They're not talking about Trump, but it's like really important information to have. But it's not traumatizing because they're not talking about that. They're talking about algae. And she gets insight and they get insight and maybe they change each other's mind, you know? So I think that just things that are just not political but in a way serve this political function, not just a bridging difference, but just, you know, if you're in a gentrifying neighborhood, you're from one of those identities, not the other, like join something where people on the other side of that are actually talking
it's
to
humanization.
You. Like gardens, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And then there's the political stuff, which is like actually just getting organized. Like if 10% more voters in your side voted, if you just raised turnout by like 10%, it'd be the biggest landslide in American history. It's so, if we all just found someone to drag, right? Like, it's easy to, how tantalizingly easy that is. But it actually requires a tremendous, tremendous amount of organization and actually doing stuff. And I just, the second part of what I want to say is about a very tangible place to work on these issues is this emerging 2020 Democratic primary, which I think is going to be a fantastic contest. A lot of people are angry about the number of candidates. I am not. A lot of people think it's going to be tense. It is, but I don't think that's bad. You know, this is going to be the Thanksgiving dinner where we finally talk about what's going on in our family, right? And that's really good from my point of view. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it's good. You are going to have available to you everything on the spectrum, from democratic socialism to I really wish I was the senator from Goldman Sachs, right? That's all available to you. And a lot of shades of, you know, all the way from one side to the other. We're going to have a conversation about age and whether that's an appropriate thing to be worried about or not. We're going to have from 37 to, you know, 108 or whatever Bernie is.
700.
I can say that. I just spent 9 days with Bernie on the road, so I can say that. And I'm sure he wouldn't laugh. He laughed in the Reagan administration once. you know, I think we're going to have a conversation about the core issue you talked about. In a way, you raised the philanthropic thing about bleeding versus the system. I think the Democratic Party version of that is like, do we just beat Trump and like shut up about everything? Or is talking about all the things that led to Trump, like a economic system that doesn't work for most people, is this precisely the moment to speak up about a bunch of things? Or is this the moment to shut up about everything and just do that? I think that's I have a view on that question, but I'm conflicted on my view of that. I think it's a hard question that I'm not sure the answer to. This is gonna be a fantastic contest. And I think it is crucial that we don't just let this be a contest of personalities, but that we apply the following lens to this race that I think helps you see more clearly. Who in this race is actually interested in rearranging the power equations of this country, right? Who is going to bring some people up, or wants to, without bringing anybody down?
Right.
Or who actually wants to make some people less powerful in American life in order to make more people more powerful? And I think that is a crucial litmus test. I think we know in Sanders and Warren we already have that, but I think for some of the others, I don't think they're necessarily fully declared on that question. I don't have a sense with Kamala that I entirely know. I have an instinct, but I don't think we know yet. We haven't had any debates. I don't think I know with Mayor Pete yet where we land on that thing. And I have this theory that a lot of certain presidents in American history are stadium builders, right? They build a stadium that every future president for decades has to play in, ideological stadiums. FDR built a stadium. There was a left side of the field after FDR and a right side of the field, but they were all in his stadium. Nixon was playing in FDR's stadium, which is why he created the EPA. Eisenhower was playing in FDR's stadium, which is why he was fine with like 90% tax rates or whatever it was. In the Reagan built a stadium.
Reagan built the one we're in now.
And here's the bad news. We are all living in Reagan's stadium.
Ooh, it's bad.
We don't realize that. Barack Obama was on the left side of the field in Reagan's stadium. That's not a bad personality trait of Barack Obama. That's just a fact of the age. He was not a stadium builder. I also don't know that he wanted to be a stadium builder, necessarily. I'm not sure that's who he is. Bill Clinton was absolutely within Reagan's stadium. We're still in it. And so I think another question to ask that is very clarifying in this field and thinking about these questions of power is, who wants to build a stadium versus who wants the left side to get the ball again in the current stadium? And who has the ability to build a stadium?
Here, here. I love that. Don't, yes. I think we have one other question.
Hi, Dr. Stephen Hubbard, USC School of Public Policy. There are, to affect the change that you want to, that needs to be created to get rid of income inequality, there are sort of the plutocrats, the corporations, and then there's the voter. How do you see this playing out? Because unfortunately, the way I see it is that the gridlock in Washington is going to prevent enough change from the public sphere, and the plutocrats will simply ride this rocket into a hillside and we'll have a huge crash before there's enough will in the public sphere to create the change that needs to happen. So I was wondering how you see this playing out.
I think that's a possibility if we don't get our act together. But the other day, I'm sure that you did not think this is where I was going to go, but the other day I landed in an airport somewhere, and I walked towards a men's restroom, and in the entrance of the men's restroom, before you turn the corner, there were four signs. So it said men, and then it said diaper changing table, and then it said handicapped, and then it said no smoking. And you thought, I was like, this was unimaginable 30 years ago. Unimaginable. Men needing to change. Why would men need to change a diaper? Right? What's smoking? What's wrong with smoking?
You do it while you change.
Why do disabled
diaper?
People need bathrooms? And so, right, exactly. And so, on the one hand, I share the view that it feels very hard. It's hard for me to see how we'd get out of this moment. On the other hand, we make big change all the time. All the time. Right? Think of what's happened with, I mean, if you're 30 years old or younger, not if you're like 10, but if you're 30, what's happened on gay rights in your lifetime is head spinning. Head spinning from zero to close to 100. Right? In many, many people's attitudes. Right? It is not an issue that, like, you will not find a Republican member of Congress who's like, people should not be gay anymore. Right? That was a default. They don't like adoption.
They won't say it in public.
But you maybe. Can't get Mike Pence. You can't get Mike Pence to say, that's a life that shouldn't exist anymore. 5 years ago, he'd say it. I don't know. Latest.
We've made huge strides.
I agree with that.
Yes.
I'm just suggesting that when we do actually get organized and take on these issues, don't fall into this idea that nothing ever changes, because things have changed all the time in our lifetime. And I think what is happening now is people are waking up to the idea that they are being ruled by people who are ruling them by telling them how much they're helping. And I think if we continue to raise consciousness around that, I actually think those people are not very powerful at all, because there are so few of them. And I will tell you, from 9 days on the road in Bernie land, going to, you know, 8 or 9 states, talking to voters in all kinds of places, the number of older, beefy, white guys in camo who are tired of billionaires stealing the American dream represents a new political possibility in American life that I don't think has been tapped into.
Do we have time for one more? Two more. Look at that. Mm-hmm. This is thrilling. Who would like to help build a stadium? Yes.
Thank you. This has been fun. And actually, you're hilarious, which I wasn't fully prepared for. Yeah. So my question is about this trend within government toward tech speak and sort of tech modes of thinking around innovation and failing upward and failing fast, and sort of this idea that we need to bring
getting
people...
Getting PTSD just listening to
yeah.
you.
Well, I used to work in tech and I used to work in government. So this idea that government, even within government, government is slow and a failure and full of unhappy people. And so we need people from the tech sector to like make government efficient and make it work, when really there's plenty of evidence that a lot of government programs work quite well with very low overhead for a very long time. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about what that what that trend maybe looks like going forward and what you think about it?
Such an important question. So, you know, one overall observation before the specific is that the dynamic you're describing is part of a larger thing where I think we imagine that a lot of the injustice of the world is kind of upheld at gunpoint or upheld through like hard power. But a lot, in my view, so much of that is actually upheld by culture and specifically by the conquest of language, right? And the dissemination of some ideas that crowd out other ideas, right? If you say, you know, Sheryl Sandberg puts out the idea that lean in, you know, essentially thousands of years of patriarchy is in fact a posture problem. If the ladies could alter their angle of recline, patriarchy, no problemo. Now, that's a fraudulent idea. But you could also say, like, okay, like, people put out fraudulent ideas all the time. Like, who cares? Like, why does it matter? Well, it matters because she's powerful enough that it crowds out other ideas. And then you have conferences where they got to invite one more feminist thinker, and they invite someone who runs Lean In circles instead of Catherine McKinnon or whatever, you know. And so in this small way, the conquest of language has these huge consequences, which I think is what you're getting at. Now, you're talking about one specific one, which is this tech speak. What has been so remarkable in Silicon Valley, because remember, these are companies with like not, they don't have trucks and buses and the way Walmart, and you know, they're like small. How have they become so powerful? They've disseminated words, culture, disruption, right? Like, they're basically trying to build, Uber and Lyft are trying to build, you know, companies that can create a new alternative to avoiding the minimum wage. That's essentially the business model, right? What, but do they call it that? No, what do they call it? Micro-entrepreneurship, right? It's like a microbrewery, but for entrepreneurship, right? Empowering people. Choose your own schedule. Set your own hours. Be free. The conquest of language is so important. And so a big part, and also we play into this. When I got into airplanes, I just see like everybody playing Candy Crush instead of reading. Like, it requires people to read. We're here in a library event, so this is my plug for reading. You know, I will say, I teach a master's writing class. Right? These people want to be writers in their life. And I ask them, have you read this book in your field? Have you read this book in your field? Some of the biggest, and usually the answer is no. These are people who want to enter the field, right? And I think if we don't educate ourselves to take language back, this Orwellian stuff that will always benefit power is always going to work. And it is incredibly important to parse, particularly as journalists, as writers, to parse what people mean when they say disruption, to parse what they mean when you say effectiveness, philanthropists say effectiveness. What they're really saying is they should have this continuing, ongoing right to supervise how social change works and judge when it's working and not. The conquest of language is the most, in my view, one of the most important forms of power that we are defenseless against when we don't read, we don't think, and we kind of lose our facility and respect for words.
Hi. I'm going to go ahead and take a guess that I've traveled farther than anyone else to be here. I'm from Kansas City. My family and I are vacationing in Venice, and I found this, and I drove on Highway 10 through rush hour, so...
Which was actually harder than flying here from Kansas City, probably.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know traffic. So first of all, a lot of us in the organization I work for, really bound and determined to stay in the Midwest called IFF. We're going through massive changes internally, structural changes around race and equity. And we're looking for a lot of assistance, sources, inspirations, challenges, and we're being led through this by an organization based out of Chicago. So it's obviously very eye-opening, but it's also also now not only is work hard, but I get to be knocked on my ass personally, which is good and really hard. So I appreciate the skepticism that you bring and the deconstruction that you bring and how well it's articulated. So like I feel like it's an entry point for a lot of us to get there who maybe we've had feelings or instincts, intuitions, and now we can assign words to it and go back and actually like reference it in written form. So thank you for that. I'm wondering on the other side of this, moving forward, at least for me for tonight, moving forward, who do you both, because I'm curious for both of you, who do you see as individuals, as organizations that maybe we could kind of keep an eye on or serve as inspiration for you? I'm not looking for ideals of perfection, but maybe starting to fall in the right direction, or maybe who have been getting it right for a while. Because I think for a lot of us, what I don't want to have happen is kind of what you talk about in your book, where we treat you like a thought leader and we walk out of here feeling good and then we're back in our jobs in 24 hours and just back to the grind. So any insight on people to look towards, organizations, would be greatly appreciated.
I really want Anand to thank you for your question and for the work you're doing. It's brave. I know it's painful for me, you know, kind of being awakened and made uncomfortable, and the willingness to show up for that. It's brave work. It's necessary work and it's brave work. I want to say that. And I want Anand to have the last word. The person who comes to mind for me is someone who's on the back flap of Anand's book. So get the book, because even the people who've given the quotes are worth following. Brian Stevenson and EJI. Okay. That work is about proximity, right? He talks about having to get uncomfortable, having to get close to the problem, and having to kind of be willing to have, you know, hope in the midst of your pain as we kind of untangle this, confront all of this together. And I think I would put Anand on my list if he weren't sitting here. Another person on the back of his book is Ai-Jen Poo, the head of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and now one of the people who's brought supermajority, which, if you aren't aware of it, feminists of all stripes. I think that they're doing very courageous work around women and uniting women of all backgrounds and the men who love and respect them. Hello, you two. No, I'm teasing. I always do that. It's terrible. In this audience, it makes no sense, but unfortunately, a lot of the places I speak, it's hilarious. So I'll just say that those are some folks, and I look to Anand, and, you know, if people make me uncomfortable, sometimes that's a sign to, you know, if I have to really get way outside my comfort zone, that's often a measure of how much I can learn from these folks. And Anand, please.
I think the people I truly admire in this moment are people who are helping us see through things that most people just accepted. You know, I think one of the things that was so powerful, it's not about one person, it's about actually the thousands of women who spoke up in the Me Too movement. It wasn't just a protest movement, it was a movement that first had a component of disclosure. And it wasn't just the worst episodes being disclosed, it wasn't just the assaults and the rapes, as important as those were, and as much as those generated the big stories, it was actually thousands and then maybe millions of women just talking about all the meetings where Jane has an idea, but everybody ends up remembering that Bob had the idea because he said it louder at the end, right? And it was just testimonies of what people have been dealing with that we don't see people have been dealing with. And so someone who, it's not quite in the philanthropic realm at all, but I think it would be more fitting if I answered this way. And this is not an endorsement by any means, because I frankly have no idea what I think about this race. But I think Elizabeth Warren is a fascinating person to me right now, because she is doing the following thing. We live in a culture in which we are taught to see people's problems as individual problems. It is a training so deep in the culture that we don't even realize it's our culture, right? So people struggle with diets. They struggle with diets. Every new year, I'm gonna lose 10 pounds, I'm gonna do this. They struggle, they fail. Occasionally they succeed, but usually we fail. Why do we fail? Because there's powerful people, companies, well-connected, selling us stuff that is guaranteed to make many people fat. We struggle with our phones. Why am I so addicted to this phone? I'm so terrible, I'm so terrible. I'm gonna buy that Arianna Huffington bed for my phone, put it in another room, and then we don't and we fail. I have this lovely three-year-old. Why am I looking at my phone and I have the three-year-old? And we think it's a personal failure. And there's powerful people who are studying our psyche with every dollar they have, who are making sure that our willpower will never be strong enough. And there are people who are sitting there saying, why couldn't I just stick to the one oxy pill? Why am I up to 10 a day now? When is this gonna go too far? And they blame themselves and they're mad at themselves. And there's actually really powerful people doing that. What Elizabeth Warren is doing that I would commend to all of you is starting with the pain and the struggle of individuals and meticulously working up to systems, working up to where upstream the problem originates, working up to the glaciers from which the water falls. And she is therefore not just producing more policy ideas than you have friends, which she is. But she is actually, more significantly in my view, teaching us a new way culturally of looking at problems, which is to see a hurting person and look up to people who are doing it because they have too much power and fixes that would help the people down there by restraining that power. And that to me is a new way of looking at American life in 2019 that I really think is at the heart of solving so many of the biggest problems we share in common.
I want to say it takes a lot to render me speechless.
All of you.
All of us. I feel like probably like everyone in this audience, I have new neural pathways were forged listening to you. For everyone who's read the book already, I hope you'll get it signed. For everybody who hasn't read it, I hope you'll read it and I hope you'll take it in the spirit that I'm taking it, which is as part of the kind of, I don't want to say arsenal, I don't even, you know, around you I'm like, let's watch the violent metaphors. This is part of a tool shed that I think is necessary for everyone who is thinking about what a way forward actually looks like. Not kind of theorizing, not moralizing, not polarizing, but a practical, actionable, I mean, this is, you know, GPS, turn by turn ways to look at and think about how we can begin to dismantle what's in our way, even though it claims to be for our good. I can't thank you enough for having me join you here.
I can't thank you and all of your friends.
We loved it. We loved being with all of you. And please join me in my standing O, all of us, for this incredible writer and thinker. You are a real thought leader, by the way. A real thought leader.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.